Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Counser, and I'm joined today by the artist and writer team behind an illustrated history of one of America's most notable social movements. I'm talking about the graphic novel, The Black Panther Party. And we have the artist and writer joining us today. David Walker is right here in Portland. David, it's great to have you here.
Hey, it's good to be back.
And joining us from New York, we have artist Marcus Kwame Anderson. Welcome, Marcus.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me.
Okay, so tell us about the book. It's The Black Panther Party, A Graphic Novel History. Start us off here.
Yeah, well, as the title indicates, it's a graphic novel history of the Black Panther Party. It just came out on January 19th, 2021, which is a somewhat auspicious day because it was Trump's last full day in office as president of the United States. And this is a project that Marcus and I have been working on for well over a year, close to 2 years at this point. And I was coming off of having written The Life of Frederick Douglass, which was also a graphic novel for the same publisher, 10 Speed Press. And this is my follow-up project. And I was fortunate enough, and fortunate isn't a strong enough synonym, adjective, I should say. And I don't have any other synonyms for fortunate right now to describe working with Marcus, which has just been easily one of the best, if not best, experiences of my professional career.
Wow. That's high praise. And it's kind of, you know, surreal to me because David definitely was and is one of my favorite writers, like far predating this project. So just working with him alone was really amazing. And then on top of that, the subject that we were working on, this was basically a dream project for me. And it was kind of like a convergence of a lot of my interests as far as like comics and Black history. And this was perfect.
Marcus, it seems like you might have had a tightrope to walk with this book. You've drawn a number of superheroes, other cartoon characters where you get to pose them in dynamic situations. In the Black Panther Party, you're working with the images of real people. A number of them are still alive. And so right. The trick here, it seems like it would be to be accurate without being lifeless.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, funny you mentioned that. It's something that I've been interested in speaking about because a lot of thought went into it. I haven't really been asked that question much, so thank you. But like the whole process, like David had compiled a lot of reference materials and kind of had me ready to go with that from the beginning of the project. I also researched tirelessly throughout. But yeah, a tightrope is a good way to describe it, or I would say maybe finding a balance. But I very much wanted this to still be a comic book, you know, even though these are real people. And I wanted to try to avoid it being a lot of static images. So we have the biography pages on different figures that we're covering throughout the book. And those would traditionally be, you know, my interpretation of a still photograph of the person. But then there's a lot of scenes where I'm having to, illustrate a conversation between, say, Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton. And nobody was there. You know, there was no camera. It's not, I mean, if it was today, if it was 2020, there would be like 15 shots of any of these given conversation, you know what I mean, from everybody's phones. But like back then, like cameras were not ubiquitous. So yeah, like it was, I really found myself having to use my imagination and be inventive and dynamic as far as like, you know, panel design and characters, just, making them living, breathing people. You know what I mean? But while still being true to their likenesses. And then that point that you raised about the fact that a lot of these people are still alive is very much on my mind. A lot of these people in the book are people I respect. You know, I think I've told David a story that as I was drawing, a lot of times I would, just listen on YouTube to different people from the party speaking. And there was one talk that Bobby Seale was giving like sometime in the last 10 years. And he brought up his dislike for Mario Van Peebles' 1995 movie Panther, and it was just funny for me because I was just like, oh man, I really want to make something that Bobby Seale is not going to hate, you know. And so I'm hoping we did. I don't know one way or the other, but you know, it was very much on my mind that these are people's real stories, and I thought about myself, you know what I mean, if there were moments of my life that were really important and someone else was telling that story, you know, how much of a careful eye I might, you know, place on that story.
Well, David, I can't help but remember back in the day when you were film critic for the Willamette Week newspaper in Portland. And yeah, you definitely expressed some disappointment with the Mario Van Peebles film Panther.
Oh yeah. I've never been silent about my criticism of his work, but especially Panther was a movie I was very disappointed with. And I thought about that a lot when I was doing the writing. You know, it's a movie that's not available streaming, and you got to kind of look around to find it. But I actually sat down and tried, and that's the crucial word. I tried to rewatch it at one point. I found it, I think, on YouTube or something like that. And it just was, it you know, from a purely critical standpoint, there was a lot of things wrong with it. But I think that one of the biggest problems was that it was trying to find a balance between being some sort of pop entertainment and then being informative. And like, it just didn't work. It wasn't a good mix. And so going into this project, it was always, you know, in the forefront of my mind. It's like, the most important thing is that we deliver information in a way that's clear and concise and visually captivating. If the visuals aren't captivating, I think a lot of people don't even bother to pick up a book that's a graphic novel. Or I read a review of this book recently. Someone called it more of an illustrated text. I think it's a combination of the two. But yeah. I also live in fear of, and not so much fear of Bobby Seale. There's some other members of the party that I worry about getting on their bad side.
The figure in the book that I'm most familiar with is Fred Hampton. Mm-hmm. I was a grade school kid in Chicago when he was killed by the police. We had a family friend by the name of Mary Powers. She ran a local police watchdog organization called Citizens Alert. And I'm told that she actually toured the Hampton apartment in the wake of the shooting. The police had not completely secured the scene, which turned out to be bad news for their version of the incident.
Yeah, that's a fairly famous story. Basically, how the conspiracy to kill Chairman Fred was exposed. And I haven't talked to her in ages, but I used to be friends with a woman whose father was one of the people in the apartment when it happened. He was a member of the Panthers. And I know a bunch of people from Chicago who have their stories. You know, they remember when it happened, or their parents remember when it happened. And it really, depending on you know, who you talk to from Chicago, it's an integral part of the history of Chicago. And in terms of Panther history, it's one of the most notable moments in Panther history too. It's the sad thing is that I feel like the most memorable moments from Panther history all involve someone getting killed, whether it was Bobby Hutton, Fred Hampton, Bunchy Carter in Los Angeles. And that's, it's kind of sad to me, because even though those are crucial moments, that's not everything that the party stood for. That's not everything that the party was involved with.
At the same time, though, putting your life on the line was kind of what was going on. I mean, every incident that that kind of made the news was a life or death incident on some level.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that the interesting thing is that, and I've thought about this a lot, you know, the vast majority of the Panthers were very young. The original founding members, the oldest of them was 26 at the time. A lot of the rank and file were mostly kids right out of high school. And at that time, there was no other political activist movement in this country up until that time that had ever been that aggressively attacked by law and order, by the police, by the FBI. There have definitely been instances, but nothing like the Panthers. And I think that if you combine the level of aggression that law enforcement placed, and then the, I guess you maybe could call it the hubris of youth. But when you're 18 or 19 years old, you don't, it's not necessarily occurring to you that the FBI might pay somebody to drug you and then send police in to assassinate you while you sleep, which is what happened with Fred Hampton. I think there's this romanticized idea of the Panthers putting their lives on the line, and they certainly did. There's no doubt about that. But I sometimes question if when they said they were prepared to die for the people, if they really knew what that meant until they started dying for the people, if that makes any sense at all. I really do think that there was a, and I think it was with Bobby Hutton, where there was a moment, because Bobby Hutton was one of the first high profile members to get killed, where I think people were like, whoa, wait a minute. They were, you know, Hutton was killed in 68. Party was founded in 66. And like, in a lot of ways, Bobby Hutton's death was the beginning of where the attacks became really, really violent.
Right. Yeah. And for me, like, when I think about, you know, David's point about the youth of the party, the rank and file and the more high profile members, when I think about, like, you know, when I was like in my early 20s, you know, I mean, it's not that I was like the most reckless kid or anything by any means, but it's just like your perspective on life, on your mortality, it's like totally different. You don't necessarily walk around thinking I'm invincible, but like you do, like, you know, I'm far more aware of the realities of life now than I was at that age. So, and yeah, and I think about, and you know, Bobby Hutton was younger than even those other young Panthers that we're talking about, you know? So that was 100% one of the hard, between Bobby Hutton and Fred Hampton's death, those were the hardest and most challenging parts of the book to illustrate and to bring to life. And one of the things that was important too was just kind of communicating the gravity of the situation. And like, you know, we told the story of the aftermath of his death and, you know, his funeral, Bobby Hutton's funeral, which was very well attended. And, you know, Marlon Brando and other high profile people spoke at the funeral. Yeah, like I think the way that David wrote the script, he really communicated the gravity of that event and the fact that it was kind of the beginning of a snowball of increasing violence, you know, at the hands of law enforcement.
And it's interesting, I just want to point out, because, you know, when I first heard about the Panthers, well, I heard about them when I was really young, but when I first started studying the Panthers in all seriousness, I wasn't that much older than Bobby Hutton was when he died. But as I was working on the book, I realized I was more than old enough to be his dad. And I think about when I first started reading about the Panthers and that attitude that I had, which, as Marcus said, it's not necessarily a feeling of being invincible, but I definitely slow down when I come up to an intersection more than I did when I was that age. And I tend to look both ways before I cross the street in ways that I didn't, you know. So right. You just, after a certain amount of time, I think it happens for most of us. And the sad part is you get older and that fire in your belly that drives you the way it drove, whether it was a Bobby Hutton or a Bobby Seale or a Huey Newton, you know, a lot of times that fire dies down. And it's not to say that the beliefs change, but they become tempered with maturity and wisdom. And they, you think of other ways to go about the strategies of what you try to implement. So it would be nice if the Panthers had that youthful energy with a little bit of that seasoned wisdom. And unfortunately, not only did the party not last long enough for that seasoned wisdom to ever take hold, you know, the party didn't last and its members didn't last. Some of the most important members died before they were 30.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking about the illustrated history of the Black Panther Party. We're joined today by writer David F. Walker and artist Marcus Kwame Anderson. So let's talk a little bit about the formation of the Panthers, about the early days. You spotlight in the book a number of lesser known figures in the formation of the Panthers. People are familiar with Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale and Stokely Carmichael, but you introduce us to Mark Comfort, mm-hmm. who was a bridge between the Montgomery and Oakland civil rights movements. And yeah, even though he was never officially a member of the Panthers, he was an influence.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, especially with Mark Comfort in particular, because there's a lot of footage of him, and there's quite a few famous photos of him, but it's never attributed that it's him. It's just always like a member of the Black Panther Party at Sacramento. And as I was doing research on the actual history of the Panthers, his name came up in a few books, and it was talking about the impact that he had in the Bay Area in terms of activism and anti-police brutality activism in particular. And I just thought it was, you know, it was interesting because the Panthers didn't spring up out of nowhere. You know, it's not like they just appeared overnight. There, you know, aside from the circumstances in this nation that led to their formation, there were some key people. And there was one book that really went in depth to the impact that Mark Comfort had, down to the fact that, if I remember correctly, there was a point where before Bobby and Huey had formally formed the Panthers, they'd both been arrested, and it was Mark Comfort who bailed them out of jail. And so he really was this unsung hero of the Bay Area Black Power movement. And the interesting thing, he died very young, and he had moved to Klamath Falls, Oregon, which is one of the most racist places you could possibly imagine. And I want to say he died before he was 40. And it's just, you know, to me, it's interesting because history is full of people. The world is full of people like that. You just don't necessarily know their name. And to me, the moment I put together the fact that this person I was reading about in some of these books was also this person I was seeing in all these images, and that he wasn't even technically a member of the Panthers, it was like, I got to know more about this guy.
Yeah, and he was part of the student nonviolent coordinating committee before he decided that nonviolence maybe wasn't the be-all end-all.
Yeah, SNCC, you know, the student nonviolent coordinating committee went through, I mean, there you could do a graphic novel about their history as well. I was thinking about that recently. I mean, from the freedom rides that they did. And the thing is that, you know, SNCC started out again as this nonviolent movement, and then they morphed into the Black Power movement. And the Black Power movement, as we know it, as we think of it, like the Panthers especially, really grew out of what SNCC had evolved into. And it's like, I don't have the energy to write another graphic novel like this right now, but SNCC is definitely one of those organizations that, you know, John Lewis was part of SNCC. And it really was, that organization was really the bridge between what you would call the more mainstream civil rights activists, Martin Luther King and the people that believed in nonviolence, and then the other side of the equation, which was the Panthers. And you know, Malcolm X had already died by the time the Panthers were formed. And so it was more like Malcolm X's ideology was an influence on them, but he was never, he didn't live long enough to see that organization grow. And again, there's another person whose life is screaming for a great graphic novel. I don't think I'll be the one to do it. This is what it comes down to, Conch. And you've known me long enough to know that I'm one of those people who, when I start to study history of anything, you can't just look at that thing. You definitely have to look at least 10 to 15 steps removed from it, going back 10, 15 steps to understand. You can't just go, the Black Panthers formed in October 1966. You got to go, well, what are 10 things that happened that were crucial in the formation of that party? And then when you find those 10 things, you're going to find another 10 things and then another 10 things. And not to say that you have to put them all into whatever you're working on, but I do believe that contextualization is crucial, especially if you're trying to do something that has any sort of, I don't know if validity is the right word, but in my mind, I guess validity is the right word.
Yeah. For me, like when I read the script, I'm kind of a context nerd, you know what I mean? So when I got to the point very early on where David specifically was like, in order to understand this organization, we need to look at the conditions in the history of this country that like necessitated the organization. I just was like, all right, I'm in, you know, because that's where so many discussions in our society fall apart. In America, we approach politics, we approach policy and a lot of things as though they're team sports, you know? And when you take that oversimplified approach, it's easy to take the wrong position on something because, you know, if you're just like, well, your team is just a bunch of commies or whatever, then, you know, why give serious consideration to the needs of a community or a group of people, et cetera, you know what I mean? But like, if you approach it from a context perspective, in good faith, you know, that's another thing that's missing oftentimes. But like, if you approach in good faith and you take context into consideration, it makes all the difference in the world. We all have, just name a subject, we all have like different peripheral images in our head of what that is. You know, when we hear a word and the Panthers, it's like, you know, that's like times 100, you know, people's the images that they have in their head of what that is. And it's oftentimes oversimplified. So, you know, I think that's one thing, as I've heard feedback about the book, a lot of people have really seemed to have appreciated the context that we gave at the beginning of the book before diving into the story.
Yeah, and I did some similar things in the Frederick Douglass book, but going back to what Marcus said, one of the things I wanted to try to do without it being super heavy-handed, and you'll notice what I focused on and what we focused on, Marcus and I focused on leading up to the formation of the Panthers, were significantly traumatic things. So it was the death of Emmett Till. It was the deaths of Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner. It was, you know, the death of Medgar Evers. We have images of all of the civil rights martyrs that there were images of. There was two that there were no photos of them. But I wanted to sort of try to recreate a feeling of what it would have been like in the 60s to be watching the news and to be hearing about this stuff on the radio or seeing it on TV or reading it in newspapers. I knew that if we could contextualize it in some capacity, we might also be able to engage the reader enough that by the time you get to the formation of the Panthers, you can at least understand why some people would have done this. The problem is, and again, Marcus can talk about this too, is like, that's a lot of research into just ugliness, you know, just writing about Emmett Till, which is only a page in the book, but you want to get as much information as you can and make sure that you know it. And it's like, everybody in America should know who Emmett Till is, but at the same time, no one should ever have to research what happened to him, because it will mess you up. You know, it'll mess you up for quite some time, but then you throw in all the other things that you're studying, whether it's, you know, the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, and you're going, okay, wait a sec, how old were those girls again? I got to get their ages right. And so you're sitting there and you're realizing, okay, there was a 12-year-old kid that was killed. And then, you know, whether or not you're going to put it in the book, I think most people are going to go, well, what happened to the people who bombed that church? What happened to the people who killed Emmett Till? And then you follow that research down, and it's like, and after a while, you're just, I don't know if broken is the right term, but I will say that over this last summer during the Black Lives Matter protests, nothing I saw on the news surprised me, because I had spent so much time studying what had happened in the 60s, especially as it related to the Panthers and police brutality.
Yeah, and on that point, you know, during the summer, it was a surreal moment, because I was really, you know, obviously I found inspiration in the outpouring of, you know, energy, right, on behalf of Black Lives, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, far too many other people. But at the same time, and it's one of the things I don't like to be correct about, but I was like, oh, wow, there are a lot of people watching Fox News, listening to Rush Limbaugh right now, getting really angry. And those people were quiet initially relative to what we would come to see later. But I was like, there is going to be a big backlash to this. And it's an election year. when we have a demagogue in office. But my predictions of this backlash was specifically based on the history that I know, specifically based on the patterns of American history, that like every time there is even the semblance of progress, you know, on behalf of, you know, marginalized people in general, but Black people specifically, there is a violent backlash. I think it's somewhat reductive to say that everything is exactly the same right now as it was in the 60s, because I think that that diminishes the hard work that a lot of people have done to get us to this point. You know what I mean? But the overall energy and dynamics of living in a white supremacist country, they don't change unless that country is really willing to look at itself and make that change, you know? And that's why there is this cyclical nature to the events that we're documenting and the events that led to the start of the party and you know, the things that we are protesting against now and we're facing now. So yeah, we got to get our stuff together, America.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that, you know, we can write a new chapter.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking about the illustrated history of the Black Panther Party. We're joined today by writer David F. Walker and artist Marcus Kwame Anderson. Well, history is a moving target. History is a fluid thing. It's right. Like, David, you did this graphic history of Frederick Douglass, and Frederick Douglass has been coming around again. He's in The Lord God Bird, this series on Netflix. You get the news, you got the history, you got mythology. They all converge and they all intermingle. So the time the Black Panther Party was coming up, the news didn't cover them very well. They didn't like to cover the free breakfast program that they were running. And now, you know, they're looked at in a totally different way 50 years, 60 years later.
Well, you know, yes. And here's the interesting thing that a lot of people need to understand. There was a time when Muhammad Ali was the most hated man in America, at least the most hated Black man in America. And the same with Malcolm X. You know, Muhammad Ali is now revered as the greatest boxer of all time, one of our most beloved athletes. But there was a time when he was absolutely hated in this country. Malcolm X, there was a time when very few people knew who he was. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Spike Lee made his movie. So as you said, you know, history in and of itself is such an odd thing. There's a movie coming out in about a month or so about the killing of Fred Hampton called Judas and the Black Messiah. And 3-4 months from now, a lot of people in this country are going to know who Fred Hampton was. But today, there's a lot of people who don't know. And so it's interesting to watch how people become informed. And, you know, history in and of itself is a myth, right? Especially the history that we're taught in school. And the country that we live in right now is a byproduct of the myths of history that have been peddled in the bill of goods that was sold to so many of us and some people who actually believed it. You know, one of the biggest myths in this country is that history is written by the winners. And that's the biggest lie you're ever going to hear, because the history of the Civil War was literally written by the Confederacy. And as a direct result of that, the vast majority of people, especially in the states that formerly been in the Confederacy, is this actual belief that the Civil War was over states' rights. Because every textbook that said the Civil War is fought over the rights of states to own slaves was edited to get the own slaves part out. And I can tell you, as someone who has read the Articles of Secession for every state that was in the Confederacy, every single one lists they were fighting to keep their slaves. So when I hear people quote me about history or try to correct me, before I correct them, I usually will go do some research, but it's like, I'm the last person you want to come at with, you know, with your idea of historical facts, because most people just don't get it. It's interesting because the moment you start to dig beneath the surface of what I call the historical myths, you find these things that are shocking And most people don't like to be shocked. Most people don't like to be told they were wrong. Most people don't, you know, most people don't like to be told, hey, the Star Wars prequels were terrible, because they have invested so much of their self-worth in both the history that they think they know and the things that they love, the things that their identity is built around. And we're seeing a cross-section of this country right now fighting to hold on to those myths. And this is what America is going to have to deal with. Not to get all political, because we are talking about a graphic novel, right? So,
yeah, I remember.
So I've never been political.
So. Yeah, I remember hating history class in high school because the textbooks were always like, well, this happened because it was inevitable. And then after high school, I checked out the series on PBS, Eyes on the Prize. Mm-hmm. And I was like, damn, you know, things could have gone either way, like the Mississippi Freedom Caucus. You know, they crashed the convention, and it was like, you know, all these long shots, like some of them failed, some of them succeeded. And it was like, history is really dynamic and interesting.
It is. It's so, and it's funny that you mentioned Eyes on the Prize, because in my memory that is not the best at this age, that might have been one of the first places I really truly learned about the Panthers. It may have been before that, but I know that there was two seasons of Eyes on the Prize, and at least one of those seasons had several episodes, because one of them was specifically about Fred Hampton. And I love that series, even though it's pushing up on 40 years old. I think it's still relevant, and I'm always telling people to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a quote in there that to this day I refer to. They're interviewing a guy, I believe he's from New York City, and you know, he's a white man, and he's speaking about his suspicions about Black people and Black men in particular. And I always cite it to people because it's strangely honest. It's messed up what he says, but it's strangely honest. And I'm paraphrasing, but he says something like, you know, the reason why, you know, when I see a Black man, I tense up and whatever, is because I'm afraid that at some point, he's going to think about all the terrible things that my people have done to his people, and he's going to want to take it out on me. And I cite that because I think a lot of people aren't as disgustingly honest, insightful and honest as this guy. You know what I mean? But I think they are playing out that same dynamic in their fears, you know, of Black people in particular, without even having the conscious, like, honesty to know that that's what they're acting out. So, but yeah, no, that series was incredible. And you're right. I mean, if we had that in the classroom, I think history would have been a lot more engaging for a lot of us. I remember my teacher talking about Manifest Destiny without any type of critical analysis. And I just was like, this sounds like nonsense. You know what I mean? But like, it was delivered with a straight face as like, well, yeah, you got to manifest your destiny, blah, blah, blah. Like, so.
One not insignificant difference between the era of the Panthers and nowadays is back in 1970s, no one had a phone camera.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, for some descendants of the white guys with fire hoses, that hasn't seemed to catch up with them. They're still doing crazy stuff for the camera.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's because there's been no accountability, you know. And I think, and this isn't to defend anybody, but I know that, like, while we were working on this book, while I was doing the writing and the research, there was a lot of the Me Too stuff was going on, and last summer there was some more Me Too stuff that happened within the comics industry, and in this situation, it was almost everybody involved was people that I knew, and it was like, you know, as a man, it really took women who were really good friends of mine to come out with their stories in ways that they never should have had to come out with, for me to really finally go, oh, I get what this is all about now, you know? And it's not to say that I was dismissive of Me Too before any of this, but it was, I think that there's, for a lot of people, there's a moment of awakening, for lack of a better term, where you just go, oh, and you can't go back. You can't go back to how you saw things before. And as to me, as painful as that moment of awakening is, Like, we should all have it. What I do try to tell people is that we never want to erase anything, truly erase anything, because then we forget that it happened, you know, and we need to remember these things. I think I always say, you know, going back to what I was saying about the rewriting of the Civil War history and the history of the Confederacy, that's essentially the same thing as cancel culture. It's like you erase something from history and it just doesn't go away. So it's fine to get rid of something and to change something, but we need to keep the artifacts and the memories and the lessons. Otherwise, this is how it keeps happening over and over and over again.
Well, one of the things that is obviously important for both of you in putting together the Black Panther Party Illustrated History here is complexity. And you you show that the main players in the Black Panthers, they were not above a hustle. And let's see, was it Huey Newton's idea to start selling copies of Mao's Little Red Book to Berkeley students, right?
Yep. Well, at least that's what everybody says. So we'll go with that as being the gospel truth. Everybody says that story. There's a part of me suspects that it might have been somebody else's idea. But yeah, that was how they raised money to buy guns, actually, was selling copies of the Red Book.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking about the illustrated history of the Black Panther Party. We're joined today by writer David F. Walker and artist Marcus Kwame Anderson. I want to ask Marcus, you were born in Jamaica, right? Kingston, Jamaica?
Yeah, I was born in Kingston. We moved here when I was about, just under 2 years old. So, you know, but definitely, you know, I mean, Jamaica was all around me in my family and, you know, people that we were around.
How has that influenced your work? You said that you really appreciate the opportunity to represent the diversity of the African diaspora. So you take kind of an international stand on artistic influence. And when I say artistic influence, it doesn't have to be just the visual arts.
Yeah. So no, that's a very good question. So obviously I've lived the majority of my life in the United States, and I've experienced being a Black man in the United States. It's not like, you know, police are going to be like, oh, wait, he's Jamaican, you know, and treat you better. So it's kind of like I've had the Black American experience. So a lot of the creative people I've been influenced by, like specifically growing up, like there was very much a line between, like, you know, the musicians that I love, like, you know, the Bob Marleys, the Nina Simones. And these were people who musically created something that I really dug, but they were also communicating just Black experience, Black struggle, you know, Black hope, all of it, like, you know what I mean? And making like activist music. And I've referenced Public Enemy quite a bit in talking about this book, because hearing Chuck D speak about several Panthers on Takes a Nation and Millions to Hold Us Back, like, was really the first thing that made me be like, hey, I need to learn more about these people that he's speaking about. So I say all that to say that, like, Black American art, that whole, you know, blues culture, blues people, it really moved me and is a part of me and informed my creativity. But yeah, like, I definitely do not separate that from, you know, my heritage. And if you look at it, like, Stokely Carmichael became, you know, Kwame Ture, and, you know, moved to Africa, and some of my other heroes like Nina Simone and James Baldwin, you know, they lived abroad. So I like the idea of Blackness, because it's universal, it's worldwide, you know what I mean? It includes all of us. So yeah, like, you know, my when I speak about diaspora, there is a reason why I specifically refer to that in my artist statements and biographies, because the struggle of Black people here, I'm a part of it. I'm not apart from it, you know, but I also, you know, that's informed by so many other people, you know, and the people we wrote about in this book. many of them studied people from around the world. So I have a wide array of influences, and my concept of Blackness is both here, but also just worldwide.
Yeah, I do want to ask about, you said you had already been enjoying a lot of David's work when you were tapped to do the artwork for the Black Panther Party graphic novel.
Yeah, I was, my best friend Leo, way back, we're talking like early 2000s, had a bunch of David's old magazine, Badass Mofo. So that was like the first time I came across anything David had done. And like, we geeked out over that. And then, yeah, like when I started seeing David's name pop up in comics, I just was right on it. And his Shaft graphic novel run was just, it was amazing to me. And like my dad had, I would just read my dad's old books, you know, when I was a kid, and he had like a couple of Shaft novels. And of course, you know, I like the Richard Roundtree film, which I know David isn't as crazy about, but and I learned you know, from David's retelling, because his version of John Shaft was the one from the novel, and it was just really, really cool to me. But like, I tell people that all the time when I talk about this book, I really feel fortunate. So the fact that David looked at my work and was like, I can see something in this work, you know what I mean, that would fit with this project, I'm just profoundly grateful for. You know?
Well, David, Marcus just mentioned your popular 1990s self-published zine series, Badass Mofo. And I may still have some copies myself. I know I donated a few issues to the local zine library. But yeah, that zine led to a series of books about blaxploitation films and spaghetti westerns and other cinema that you love, or maybe have a love-hate relationship with.
Yeah, led to all kinds of stuff. And sometimes it's interesting because this year is actually the 25th anniversary of Badass Mofo, which kind of blows my mind when I think about it. And it also blows my mind when I realize, you know, when I stop and think about how many people that I know now who knew me through that work long before we ever met personally. And I'm definitely planning something for the 25th anniversary, simply because I teach part-time now. I teach a writing course at Portland State University. And one of the things I try to express to my students is that you shouldn't run and hide and try to get rid of your old work. Even if you don't like your old work is what led you to who you are today. And so I think about that all the time with Badass Mofo. And so I've been going through some of the old writing, and it's interesting. When I first proposed this book to 10 Speed Press, I knew that they were gonna ask for artists, and I knew Marcus's work through Snow Days, which was a webcomic that he was doing. And Marcus also does these portraits that are a little bit closer to what I would define as fine art. I think some people, you know, might still consider it a little bit commercial art, but there was a distinct style difference between some of this other work that he was doing and then the stuff in Snow Days. And so what I was seeing, though, was a very eclectic style that varied. And then I knew what he could do as a more traditional cartoonist, comic book artist. And so even before I had submitted his work, I had sort of buttered everybody up and explained why I wanted a specific style that people might look at and go, oh, this is kind of cartoony. And I said, yeah, you know, the reason I want that is because this is a pretty heavy subject. And, you know, if we have art that's too photorealistic or too, I guess, has too much of a hard edge, and this isn't to say that Marcus's art is soft in any capacity, but I want a style that would contrast the violence, some of the serious nature. I wanted it to be something that, like, if some seventh grade kid brought this book home from the library and their parents were like, what are you doing? Look at this Black Panther Party book. And then they open up and they go, wow, these pictures are really cool. Oh, this is kind of, you know, that's what I wanted. And I knew it. I knew that this guy could deliver it. So a lot of it was just like buttering up the editorial team and really keeping my fingers crossed that he would be interested in doing it and be available, because it was a lot of hard work. There's a lot to be said when you're doing a project like this of having somebody not only who you like their work and you trust their artistic ability, but you also know, and this was crucial too, I knew from the subject matter of art that Marcus was posting that he had some semblance of interest and understanding of what we were doing and what I wanted to go for. And that meant everything to me. And it still does. It still means everything to me.
Well, that's high praise. I mean, especially considering the range of artists that you've worked for. Marcus mentioned Shaft, the comic book Shaft. Bilkis Evely was an artist on that. And Bill Sienkiewicz, the legendary Bill Sienkiewicz, did the covers.
Him and Dennis Cowan, yeah.
Luke Cage for Marvel. You had Guillermo Sana and you had Sanford Green for Power Man and Iron Fist. So, yeah, you are valued as a writer.
Well,
your technique is valued.
And I appreciate that. With this project in particular, I felt like, I've been moving more towards nonfiction, and, at the risk of sounding like an egomaniac or something, I wanted to create a book about the Black Panther Party that would be remembered even after I'm gone, right? I really did. I wanted to create an indispensable text that could be the springboard for studying more about the Panthers or about the 60s. And I knew the only way that was going to happen was it had to look, and I don't say this lightly, it had to look better than it reads. There's a sequence in our book when the Panthers go to Sacramento to protest at the Capitol. And that entire sequence is one of my favorite sequences in the book. It's one of the most cinematic sequences, but there's one page in particular where you're on the steps of the Capitol, and with each panel, the Panthers are getting closer and closer. Like, I just love that page. And I know what I wrote, and I know that page exists because I wrote it, but what I wrote will never look as good as what Marcus put on that page. That's what comics are, right? I tell this to my students because, the writing course I teach is writing for comics. It's like, if you're not trying to hook up with an artist who is better at telling a story with pictures than you are with words, forget about it. Just go home, and that's it. People don't understand my commitment to this medium in that regard. When it comes to comics and graphic novels, you, as a writer, you're only going to be as good as the art that is in your book. So like I said, I've been lucky. I've never worked on a comic in my professional career that I'm embarrassed for people to look at. I have some stuff that I'm embarrassed for people to read the words on the page, but in terms of the images, they all look great.
David, I know that one of the fights that you've been battling is the stigma in our society against discussing depression and anxiety and mental health in general. Mm-hmm. Particularly among Black men. One of your quotes that I saw is, no one ever asks, hey man, how's your mentals?
No one, very few people ask that. No, I think that, look, as a nation, not just as Black folks specifically, Black men specifically, but as a nation, we don't talk about mental health nearly enough. And there's a reason why so many people over just the last week have been walking around with feeling like a little bit less weight on their shoulders, a little bit, more relieved. And it's like, we're a nation that has been traumatized for 4 years straight. Now, the fact of the matter is that some of the people who've been traumatized don't realize they've been traumatized. But for me, it's, the key thing is you're going to have enough trouble getting help if you have any sort of mental health issues as it is in this country, right? Because it's not necessarily taken that seriously. But if you're a Black person, you're never taken seriously. And a lot of, there's a lot of people within the Black community that see these things as a sign of weakness. And I'm not gonna lie, I was definitely one of those people. We, when I was younger, I had no concept of what depression was really all about, what anxiety was really all about. Although in some cases, for quite some time, I was suffering from both and I just didn't know it. You know, I look back on my grandfather, he's been gone for many, many years, but like I'm more than 99% sure that my grandfather suffered from depression, but he was from a generation and era that never called it that. So, you know, my grandfather would just, he would say, oh, you know, I'm feeling blue today, or I'm feeling funky today. And that's how he talked about it. But when I look at, especially later in his life, some of the traits that he exhibited and some of the way he responded to things, it's like, oh yeah, no, he was depressed, you know, and it's interesting because as my depression has gotten worse over the years, it never occurred to me that, you know, my dad died really young, as did all of his brothers. It never occurred to me that maybe depression ran amongst men in my family, you know. But then when I also look back at the history of substance abuse in my family, it's like, oh yeah, maybe part of that was in response to the depression that they may have been dealing with. So to me, it's like, if we're going to get up and talk about money, cash, hoes, things like that, all those other things that we've done, and like, we should also talk about anxiety, depression, and neuroses, you know, maybe that'll be the title of my hip hop album.
You're gonna drop some rhymes, huh?
Yeah, right.
I mean, I have dabbled. So if you need somebody for bars, you know, I mean, it's like, no. But no, if I could add, I definitely want to cut you off. But like what you said right there, you literally took the words out of my mouth, because as I've done a lot of work in my own life, you know, with dealing with depression, and especially specifically between my late 20s and early 30s, you know, I went through a rough time, and I realized that, like, you know, I had what David just described. I had experienced that, having experienced depression before I even had a word for it, you know. And also, like, the more I learned about it, as I worked on it, I realized that pretty much like my entire nuclear family unit, I feel like we all suffered it. You know what I mean? I feel like it manifested itself differently, you know, maybe with my mom and my father, you know, or even my brother, but like, it was there. And I think that that is something that is unfortunately and really sadly very distinct to the Black experience. Is not that other people don't experience depression, but it's so normalized. And, you know, a lot of people in my life, and, you know, this is somewhat similar to what David was talking about the things that he learned from women in his life that he was close to and their experiences. But there's even this whole idea of, like, you know, strong Black woman. And I've seen how that really can be harmful and destructive to a lot of Black women, because there's this idea that, like, you're supposed to be able to take anything that is put on your shoulders. You're supposed to be able to carry any weight. You know what I mean? And that's not realistic. And so, yeah, when it comes to mental health, you know, and I have not been as brave or outspoken about my own experiences. I speak about it, but, like, you know, I know David and some other people are very upfront and out there about it. And I think it's important. I think it's important that other people can see it can be a lifelong thing, and it's real. And I think acknowledging that it's real is a very important first step that sadly too many people haven't taken.
Yeah, I remember hearing that line years ago in Chicago from a woman who was saying, we don't go to a psychiatrist, we go to church. Although, you know, hey, why not both?
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing, church has value. No, I can't tell you how many people, it's funny because as I learned more, right, one of my best friends, he was talking about his stuff, and, you know, I'm just like, you're talking about depression, you know, and I specifically brought up, you know, treatment, speaking to somebody, seeking out these things. And he said, like, oh no, I have church, you know. And I definitely don't think that that's bad, but I think that it's a piece of the puzzle. You know what I mean? We're not any one thing. Human beings are complex. So yeah, like addressing some parts of it from a spiritual perspective, absolutely. But then, you know, the mind is a crazy and multifaceted thing, and you can't address it all by speaking to your pastor.
you know, your pastor or pastors and Prozac will never be enough.
That's another album title, right?
I was
there.
Gonna say,
you're giving away some gold. You're giving away some gold.
Oh, what can I say? It's one of those days.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you both?
Well, for me, there's, you know, I've always got a bunch of irons in the fire, and Marcus and I are working on trying to get a new book deal, something super top secret that will blow people's minds. And right now, I have another book that I'm writing that I can't talk about because it hasn't been announced yet. And then just about everything else is, you know, Bitter Root, which is a comic that I co-write with Chuck Brown, and that comes out through Image Comics. We're working on that. That's making its return in about a month. And really thinking about, I'd like to write some more prose, and I'm just not sure what that's going to be yet. Like, and by prose, I mean fiction. So like, I have an idea for a murder mystery, and I think I might sit down and do that, but that's a whole other set of muscles. And it's a different type of discipline that right now I'm lacking. So, but we'll see. But this project that Marcus and I are talking about, man, and that's like a, if we make it happen, it's like about 2 years, 3 years away. So it's, oh man, comics can drive you crazy sometimes.
Yeah, that project that Dave was talking about, that's the big one. I'm also finishing book two of Snow Days, which is a long, 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 long time coming. And I'm excited about getting that into the world. I think I also want to spend a little bit of time this year just catching up on doing some paintings, like, you know, traditional paintings, because it's been a big part of, you know, what drives me artistically. And I love comics, but it's like, you know, comics are so intensive that as I've done a lot of comics work over the last couple of years, just hasn't been as much time for the canvas. So, yeah.
Well, the book is The Black Panther Party, A Graphic Novel History. The writer is David F. Walker, and the artist is Marcus Kwame Anderson. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thanks for having us.
It's absolutely been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Now for our listeners who might be interested in your work, how can they find out more?
Just go to davidfwalker.com. It's all one word. I may not update the site that often, but it's got links to everything that you need to know about me, and you can find whatever you need to know.
And similarly for me, Marcus Kwame, MacrusKwame.com. And yeah, it's got all of my socials, comic work, painting, everything. You can find it all there.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.